Daisy.
And I'm Terry.
And this is the Monday Mindset Podcast,
where we share things of interest to us and hopefully to you.
So let's get started with episode number 15.
Today, Daisy is going to share something with us that is of interest to her. Daisy, what do you have to share?
Well, this week, Terry, I have another episode from Impact Theory with Tom Bilyeu, number 138, entitled Neuroscientist Explains How Your Brain is Affected by Fear, Isolation, and Anxiety. The neuroscientist in question is Muriel Zelikowski. She is the assistant professor of neurobiology at the University of Utah, and she works on neural circuits involved in emotion. They're currently working on experiments to do with social isolation, so quite timely. This is going to be one of those episodes where there aren't a lot of answers given, but questions raised and things to think about. So that was the sort of the framework of how I found it interesting. And the first thing she touched upon was the different things she's worked on and the different things she's been interested in. And she only touched on this. It wasn't really the main subject of the podcast, but it was quite interesting. And that was to do with memory. She was talking about when something traumatic happens, she was interested in how you store it across your lifespan, how it affects how you encode new memories and interact with other members of your species. And they were talking about the difference between different events that form memories, basically. So something of little consequence doesn't get lodged in your brain as a memory, but it tends to be emotionally charged events that get seared into your memories. And the bit that I found interesting, she's saying the more often you retrieve these memories, the more you solidify the memory in your brain versus these mundane events that you just forget about. And something that she just mentioned in passing, which was one of the bits that I found interesting and wanted to ask you about, she was saying there's a question, obviously, about how you remember something. And this got me thinking that you don't necessarily remember. In fact, you probably don't remember something completely accurately. Presumably, whenever you're forming a memory, it's always subjective. And so there's some kind of distortion there that gets imprinted on that memory. And they didn't go on to talk about it anymore, but it made me think about things that you've spoken about before and things that I've heard other people talking about, these neural pathways being formed. And I was thinking about this, if these memories keep getting revisited, that it's just these pathways, these ruts, if you like, that's the path of least resistance, are just getting deeper and deeper, these grooves, these tracks that you're running along. And the more you retrieve them, the more you relive them. And that got me thinking about how the sort of two different sides of retrieving those memories, it made me think of when you retrieve them in therapy. So I was thinking about how important is the environment that you retrieve those memories in? So if you're retrieving it in, say, the safe space working with a therapist to relive that memory, presumably to process it and resolve it, versus if you're retrieving that memory and reliving it by ruminating on it, say, when you're in a period of depression or anxiety or a mood state like that. Is that going to carry on imprinting on that memory and keep adding to it?
This is a really big topic. My belief is even in therapy, even in a safe environment, unfortunately, the frequent or the retelling or recounting of it does help to reinforce it and solidify it more as fact and a response that we access more easily. And it's actually one of the reasons I struggled to stay in the role of psychologist, because I think for many, maybe more traditional approaches encourage clients to reprocess traumatic events. Mm. And more in the past few years, I've really been reading more, learning more about this idea that can also do us harm, that by continuing to relive traumatic events, that again, like you're saying, that it makes it more concrete in our brain. And from your question, though, I would say maybe less damaging in a safe environment with a safe person versus, you know, if I'm remembering a traumatic experience that happened to me in the middle of the night, and I'm remembering it in the middle of the night when I'm alone in bed. Yeah, I think that could have even more negative impact. But it's also why some approaches to therapy, I think, are so useful. And we've touched on this one a little bit before, EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprogramming.
Mm.
And so it's bringing up a traumatic event or experience and helping you to reprocess it in your brain in a different way so that you don't keep storing it as the same impact. So I think without using a tool like that, I felt like I was encouraging people to just keep reliving the traumatic events. And so I found that very concerning for me as a therapist. That's not the intent of what I wanted to do with people.
Yes, presumably there's a balance between having that. If you have a traumatic event that hasn't been resolved, I mean, that's one of the reasons it hangs about, isn't it? If it isn't resolved at the time of it happening. And so I can see the argument for needing to resolve it at some point. And the process of that is going to involve having to relive it. But I can also see the side of it where every time you relive it, you're reinforcing it.
And you also bring up another point that, you know, I feel like any of these discussions get into a lot of semantics, but what does it mean to resolve a traumatic event?
Good question.
If something happened to me when I was 10, what does it mean now when I'm 51 to resolve it? I guess one way I think about that is it is to somehow come to see it or experience it differently so that I don't carry it with me in the same negatively affecting ways. But I think it also leads us to feel that once I process it, it will just be gone and resolved. And I don't think that's typically what happens either.
Well, I told you there were going to be no easy answers.
Well, thank you.
And that was actually really just a kind of a throwaway bit, really, at the beginning of her just introducing herself and saying things that were interesting. But there were just a couple of things there that really got me thinking. But into more the main part of what she was talking about, which is this work they're doing to do with social isolation. All her experiments are using mice, and they sort of go between talking about what happens with mice and referring really to that with the human experience. And I know we're not mice, but she says it is quite relatable. The sort of meat of the podcast was the impact of social isolation on particularly violence, but also persistence in fear response and abnormalities in social interaction. And it's following a period of social isolation when you're reintroduced to others in a group. And this is when these behaviors exhibit. And she did make a note on the fact that the experiments are done with complete solitary isolation, so more extreme than they would be relatable to the kind of social isolation that's going on currently due to COVID, again, relating it to the human experience. Although obviously some people have been socially isolated completely on their own. And she was saying almost any species will respond in these ways. And the fear response specifically was, she was talking about a persistent response beyond what is normal. So the normal kind of fear response to a sudden bang or something would just be that, you know, that shock and that 1 or 2 seconds fear response. But this behavior that happens after the period of isolation is this persistence of that response. So it just carrying on beyond what is normal. And social interaction, she's saying issues with lack of interest, particularly with new relationships, new introductions, but also reintroduction to existing relationships. And she got into the science behind some of it. And she was saying that there's a neural peptide called tachychiron 2 that increases in your brain after social isolation. It's smaller and more targeted than something like serotonin. And she found this interesting because it's smaller and much more targeted. So she says it's really useful if you want to manipulate it, or presumably the inference was going down treatment pathways. The way it works is it's like a web of increased activity that allows the brain to coordinate a response to social isolation that can include different things. It's like this internal conductor that coordinates these increases in violence, fear response, antisocial behavior. And things like fear and aggression are usually adaptive at low levels, but it gets hijacked in abnormal situations, like after periods of social isolation, over prolonged periods of time. And should we normally self-regulate and restore balance to things like isolation? You might self-isolate to complete a work project, for example. But what we tend to do is restore the balance and go and make connections after that to balance things out. She said the problem comes in when you can't do this over a prolonged period of time. And then these behaviors that are normally adaptive can start going off kilter. And talking about the fear response, where it's located in the amygdala, but she was saying that people are now talking about the subregions of the amygdala that are involved in different responses. With fear, increase and decrease of fear is located in the central amygdala. And they found cells that are active both during a fear stimulus and when it's switched off in this particular location. And the fear response obviously is useful in a lot of ways, but harmful when it gets pushed beyond what is normal. And she talked about a fear response to something physical, like fire, threat of attack, sense that something is off in your environment, just being aware of danger, basically. And then psychogenic fear, which is fear produced by something in your mind, potentially you could call it self-induced even. And that's a lot more difficult because it can quickly go from low levels that are adaptive to high maladaptive levels that make it difficult to function normally. And she did talk about potential ways to help with that. She talked about exposure therapy. You build new memories that compete with the old one. And the idea is to strengthen the extinction memory and make it the one that you're more likely to retrieve. That's going back to where we started with these pathways that are formed with the memories. It's introducing these new memories to overwrite the old problematic one. And she said people will have heard of this exposure therapy when it comes to things like fear of flying or fear of spiders. And she said it works really well for things like that, but it doesn't work as well for deeper trauma with things like PTSD. And she said if it works, and it's quite unlikely to work, it's only going to work in the short term. Again, it's sort of giving some kind of solution, but not a solution for when it's something that's more serious, like PTSD. But this led to a final comment about an experiment she had done, which she'd been surprised by. She'd been surprised by the results. And it was thinking along the lines of support groups for PTSD. They basically gave a group of mice PTSD and then put them back together. And she went home and she came back the next day and apparently half of them were dead. And they'd basically become extremely violent and attacked each other. And she was really surprised by this. It wasn't what she was expecting at all. So she did a second experiment where they took just one mouse out and gave it PTSD and then put it back in with the rest of the familial group, and the symptoms of the PTSD alleviated. She didn't really go into it and wasn't drawing any conclusions, but just sort of put it out there and pondering the efficacy, I guess, of support groups. And we all kind of know how effective support groups can be, but she was saying potentially maybe if everyone's had the same traumatic experience, maybe reliving it could lead to this association between the traumatic experience and the other members of the group. And maybe if the traumatic experiences are different, it could give insight into your own experience. But then she said, you know, maybe in some cases, your time would be better spent with a group of psychologically stable friends. Maybe that would be more beneficial. You know, she was comparing it with these two experiments with the mice. So again, I kind of found that interesting, thinking again, the sort of two sides of it, knowing how effective support groups can be, but then also thinking about how sometimes there's that group support that can work really well. But I could also see how surrounding yourself with other people who've experienced a similar thing and reliving that experience over and over again, and as part of a group, I could see that, again, going back to what we said at the beginning about reinforcing those memories, reinforcing that behavior, and actually potentially you're better off, like with that lone mouse, of putting yourself in a different group. So overall, more questions than answers, but a lot of things that got me thinking. And I know we crave an answer, a specific answer or a solution, but there isn't always one available. But just sort of thinking around a subject, I think, can be useful. But it got me thinking about the effect that quarantine is having on people and how there does seem to be some increase in violent responses, as well as anxiety, fear response, and antisocial behavior. And also, bigger picture, how politicians and the media use and manipulate this to stir up trouble and division. And I guess what I got out of it was just being more aware of what's going on and thinking around some of the theories and maybe what might be helpful, and reflect on how we respond to things, how we receive information, and how that then impacts our behavior. And maybe that could help mitigate what, you know, once you're aware of it, it can act as a bit of a buffer and help mitigate some of the problems they're getting stirred up by the media, for example.
It also makes me think of almost any time a topic like this comes up, it just makes me go into the complexity of it. And even if we understand one piece, how does that fit in different contexts? So let's say, for example, the question around support groups, let's say for PTSD, to me, that might help inform how to run that group. That if it's really used as a time to reprocess the trauma, that it could really have that negative impact that you're describing. Whereas if everyone in the group comes to the group with some trauma that they're working on, but the group focuses more on mindfulness skills or emotional distress tolerance. So DBT is a type of therapy used oftentimes to process trauma, that could actually be really powerful and maybe not associate the trauma itself with those people or that experience. So again, learning a little bit about the response and then thinking, how do we mitigate that potential response and highlight a response that we want to encourage instead? And then I was thinking about what you said about the isolation, and I think this is a really vast question again of, so learning a little bit about this particular, I don't remember if you said it was a neurotransmitter, but this chemical and how it increases certain things after social isolation. I think also looking at the other things that happen during social isolation. So you and I have talked before about some of the ways of kind of creating our own wellness and well-being, some of the positive chemical reactions we have from human contact, a social network, so oxytocin and serotonin and dopamine and things that what we may normally get when we are more socially connected. We're not getting some of those responses now. We're not getting some of that human contact. So my guess is it's not only this chemical that's created during social isolation or afterward, but also the positive things that are void during social isolation. And how do these things work together? And what could we then do about it to not experience as negative an impact from the social isolation?
Yeah, she was saying, obviously, much more complicated when it comes to humans. And she was talking about potential things that might mitigate it. Like, you know, does social media interaction, for example, mitigate some of the problems with isolation? And that there does seem to be a big difference in people who are in isolation on their own, as opposed to people who are in isolation with family members, even though that might bring up its own problems. Mm-hmm. In general, people who aren't isolated completely on their own tend to do better.
Interesting.
I thought it was fascinating how this propensity for violence and increase in the fear response and problems with socialization, you know, and we are seeing that to some extent.
Absolutely. What does it help you to think about or to consider as far as social isolation?
I think it's an interesting one because we've had this conversation before. I remember having a conversation with you right back when this all started, and we kind of shared the same feeling in that we're kind of used to living this way in the main. And found it a bit easier in some ways that everyone else was kind of being forced into living the way we do. So weirdly, I certainly felt sort of less isolated, so felt less impacted by the imposed isolation because I felt more connected with the world as a whole, because everyone was doing what I tend to do anyway. So it actually kind of alleviated some of the symptoms for me. Mm. But I guess what I took from it is this awareness of, if this is quite a typical response, is to maybe just being a bit more mindful when I see people behaving, I guess, in that way, just to take a moment and say, you know, this is not just you being a bit of a jerk. This is something going on in your brain. This is something that's born out of the situation that you're in. You're being more aggressive than you normally would be. And maybe, I guess, rather than reacting to those kind of behaviors, is just taking a step back and seeing it as a product of the environment.
Yeah, I like that. Kind of also seeing it as there's a biological component to what's going on right now, versus this is a character flaw in someone that they're handling it this way.
Mm.
So really to not be as, you know, maybe judgmental in how we're processing something, but to actually take into context what's going on physiologically.
And just, I think the more you're aware of it, the less likely you are to be vulnerable to being manipulated by the political situation, mm-hmm. by the media, less likely to get swept up in that. I mean, I've certainly seen people behaving over the last few weeks, the last months, much more aggressively and divisively than I would normally expect of them. So this kind of helped, for me anyway, explain that behavior a bit.
Well, Daisy, I think this definitely has brought up some new information for me to process and to think about how to put some of what's going on currently into context and ways to understand my own experience and possibly experience of other people. So I hope that everyone has a great week and that there's something from this episode that really stands out to you and helps you to think differently as well.
Have a great week.